The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Boo's landmark work of life, death and hope in the slums of Mumbai, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, was based on years of uncompromising reporting. It tells the story of Anawadi, a makeshift slum sitting in the shadow of Mumbai's shiny new international airport. She tells the tale of those she met there, from the garbage scavenger to the wannabe slumlord, the corrupt police officers to the slum's first female college graduate, as she looks at what it takes to escape poverty in one of the 21st century's great unequal cities. And it's also drawing audiences to an acclaimed adaptation at the National Theatre in London just now. Our serialisation is read by Sudha Bhushar.
It was about as hopeful a season as there had ever been in the years since a bitty slum popped up in the biggest city of a country that holds one-third of the planet's poor. A country dizzy now with development and circulating money. Dawn came gusty, as it often did in January, the month of treed kites and head colds. Because his family lacked the floor space for all of its members to lie down, Abdul was asleep on the gritty maidan, which for years had passed as his bed. His mother stepped carefully over his younger brothers, bending low to Abdul's ear.
"Wake up, fool," she said exuberantly. "You think your work is dreaming?"
Superstitious, Zehrunisa had noticed that some of the family's most profitable days occurred after she had showered abuses on her eldest son. Abdul rose with minimal whining. The pale sun lent the sewage lake a sparkling silver cast, and the parrots nesting at the far side of the lake could still be heard over the jets. Outside his neighbours' huts, some held together by duct tape and rope, damp rags were discreetly freshening bodies. A languid line extended from an orange concrete block of public toilets. It was the moment of the intimate and the familial, before the great pursuit of the tiny market niche got underway. Young girls began threading marigolds into garlands to be hawked in airport road traffic. In a small, sweltering factory, bare-chested men cranked gears that would turn coloured beads into ornaments to be hung from rear-view mirrors. Smiling ducks and pink cats that they couldn't imagine anyone, anywhere, buying. And Abdul crouched on the maidan, beginning to sort 2 weeks' worth of purchased trash, a stained shirt hitching up his knobbly spine. Anawadi sat 200 yards off the Seher Airport Road, a stretch where New India and Old India collided and made New India late. Chauffeurs in SUVs honked furiously at the bicycle delivery boys peeling off from a slum chicken shop, each carrying a rack of 300 eggs. The slum had been settled in 1991 by a band of labourers trucked in from the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu. The work complete, they decided to stay. 17 years later, almost no one in this slum was considered poor by official Indian benchmarks. True, only 6 of the slum's 3,000 residents had permanent jobs. True, a few residents trapped rats and fried them for dinner. But these individuals, miserable souls, gave those slum dwellers who didn't fry rats, like Abdul, a felt sense of their upward mobility. The airport and hotels spewed waste in the winter, the peak season for tourism, business travel, and society weddings. It was a fine time to be a Mumbai garbage trader. Not that that was the term passers-by used for Abdul. Some called him garbage and left it at that. Rising to shake out a cramp in his calf, Abdul was surprised to find the sky as brown as fly wings, the sun signalling through the haze of pollution the arrival of afternoon. Meanwhile, Abdul's brother, Mirchi, was awaiting his best friend, Rahul, a Hindu boy who lived a few huts away and who had become an Anawadi celebrity. This month, Rahul had done what Mirchi dreamed of, broken the barrier between the slum world and the rich world. Rahul's mother, Asha, a kindergarten teacher with mysterious connections to local politicians and the police, had managed to secure him several nights of temp work at the new luxury hotel across the sewage lake. Rahul, a pie-faced, snaggle-toothed boy, had seen the overcity opulence firsthand.
"Mirchi, I cannot lie to you," Rahul said, grinning. "On my side of the hall, there were 500 women."
"Ah, where was I?" said Mirchi.
"Tell me, anyone famous?"
"Everyone famous. A Bollywood party. But if the manager sees you looking at the guests, he'll fire you. Take your whole pay. You have to focus on the tables and the rug. We laid this thick white carpet, and on this one table, the chef put two huge dolphins made out of ice, with cherries for eyes."
"I forget the fish, yeah. Tell me about the girls."
"Seriously, you can't look. Not even at the rich people's toilets."
Other boys joined Rahul outside the hut, while Rahul gamely conceded he was a nothing compared with the hotel's regular workers. College-educated, tall, and light-skinned. They teased him about how he talked.
"The waiter says Saab makes you sound D-class," he said. "The right word is sir."
"Sir," someone said, rolling the R's. Then everyone started saying it, laughing. Although Mumbai was said to be more cosmopolitan than any other Indian city, Muslims were still excluded from many good jobs, including in the luxury hotels where Mirchi longed to work. It made sense to Abdul that in a polyglot city, people would sort themselves as he sorted his garbage, like with like. But Mirchi said that everyone was mixing up nowadays and that Abdul just couldn't see it, spending his days with his head in his trash pile. Abdul was now working as fast as he could in order to finish before dusk. Finally, at 6 p.m, he stood up, triumphant. Before him, 14 lumpy sacks of sorted waste. Peak season recyclables linked to a flourishing global market had bestowed on his family an income few residents of Annawadi had ever known. He had made a profit of 500 rupees, or $11, a day. Enough in time to make a deposit on a plot of land outside the city, a place where Abdul was pretty sure no one would call him garbage. Rahul's mother, Asha, took note in that winter of hope. Robert, the slumlord of Annawadi, had gone batty and pious. He had erected a Christian shrine outside his hut, then a second shrine to a Hindu goddess. On weekdays, he passed the hours in communion with 9 horses, 2 of which he'd painted with stripes to look like zebras and rented, along with a cart, to the birthday parties of middle-class children. Asha perceived an opportunity. Robert had lost his taste for power just as she was discovering her own. Let others thread the marigolds, let others sort the trash. For the overcity people who wish to exploit Annawadi and the undercity people who wish to survive it, she wanted to be the woman to see. What was clear to Asha was also clear to the corporator of Ward 76, a man of pancake makeup, hair dye, aviator sunglasses, and perspicacity. He helped Asha obtain a sinecure teaching kindergarten. In return, she would deliver her neighbours to the polls, mobilise women for a protest march. And now that she had the corporator's ear, she could fix more such problems on commission. And when she had real control over the slum, she could create problems in order to fix them, a profitable sequence she'd learned by studying the corporator.
"Corruption, it's all corruption," she told her children, fluttering her hands like 2 birds taking flight.
As Asha arrived home from a teaching job one afternoon, she saw supplicants lined up against the wall of her hut. Settling on the floor, Asha accepted the cup of tea brought by her daughter Manju and nodded for the first of her neighbours to speak. An old woman with a creased beautiful face was weeping in gratitude because Asha had helped her secure a temp job with the city government, extricating trash from clogged sewers. Before Asha had learned better, she had performed many such kindnesses for free. From her pay, the older woman had bought Asha a cheap green sari. Asha didn't care for the colour. Still,
It was good for the other visitors to hear the old woman's blessings, see the way she pressed her forehead to Asha's bare feet. Next, it was the turn of an old friend, Raja Campbell. Asha and Mr. Campbell had come to Annawadi at the same time. Now he was painful to look at, knee knobs and eye sockets mainly. He was counting on Asha to save his life. Mr. Campbell had grown up even poorer than Asha, abandoned infant, dweller on the pavement, doer of hopeless jobs. In his 30s, though, he'd had a bolt of fortune. A maintenance worker for the city government had come to pity him and offered him a permanent job to clean public toilets and falsify the timesheets of his benefactor and other sanitation workers so that they could take other jobs while collecting their municipal pay. Mr. Campbell felt honoured. He had been one of Annawadi's great successes. Until the day he collapsed. His heart was bad. The sanitation department laid him off, saying that if he got a new heart valve, he could return. But the hospital surgeons at Mumbai's public hospitals wanted under-the-table money. 60,000 rupees. Now he clenched a smile at Asha. "I don't want a handout. I want to fix my heart so I can keep working. So could you fix one of the government loans for me?" Asha looked him over. "I can see you are in a bad state. What you should do, I think, is to go to the temple and pray." He looked stunned. "Pray?" "Yes, pray for what you want every day." Asha's daughter, Manju, inhaled sharply. She knew, as Mr. Campbell did, that when Asha said go to the temple, it meant to come back with a better financial proposal. As Mr. Campbell limped away, Asha felt confident that he'd come back. A dying man should pay a lot to live. As habitually as Asha sought a financial angle in her neighbour's complaints, so far most were merely tedious. For instance, the constant bickering between the Muslim neighbours, Zerunissa and Fatima. Asha didn't care for either woman. Fatima beat her children. And Asha found Zerunissa intolerably smug. Now she and her morose son Abdul were rumoured to be making money. Dirty money, was how she put it. Her own aspirations centred on anti-poverty initiatives, not garbage. A government-sponsored women's self-help group looked promising, now that she knew how to game it. The programme was supposed to encourage women to pool their savings and make low-interest loans to one another in times of need. But Asha's self-help group preferred to lend the pooled money at high interest to poorer women whom they'd excluded from the collective. The old sewer cleaner who'd brought her a sari, for instance. "The big people think that because we are poor, we don't understand much," she said to her children. Asha understood plenty. She was a chit in a national game of make-believe, in which many of India's old problems, poverty, disease, illiteracy, child labour, were being aggressively addressed. Meanwhile, the other old problems, corruption and exploitation of the weak by the less weak, continued with minimal interference. In the West, and among some in the Indian elite, this word, corruption, had purely negative connotations. It was seen as blocking India's modern global ambitions. But for the poor of a country, where corruption thieved a great deal of opportunity, corruption was one of the genuine opportunities that remained.
And tomorrow, theft seems the only way out for an honest young scavenger, as Sudha Bhushar reads the next instalment from Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo.